Okay, let me begin. In this whole second part of the course, we're interested in the Cold War, and we're trying to get a handle on the fundamental problems here by bringing a theoretical perspective to bear. You know, just as we've done in the case of these earlier conflicts, basically a realist perspective. And what's the function of theory? Not to give you answers, right? It's to bring questions into focus, to help you see what's puzzling. In this particular case, a lot of people don't even think the Cold War is a puzzle. You know, here's this awful Stalinist communist dictatorship, and, you know, and there's this conflict with the Western democracies. Obviously, there's this huge ideological difference. They want different things because their ideologies are so different. Obviously, there's going to be a conflict, right? It's like, well, it's not so obvious when you look at things through a realist lens. Because, oh, yeah, it may be true that the Soviets wanted to communize all of Europe, ultimately all of the world, and maybe the Americans would have liked to see democratic regimes sprout up all over Europe and so on. But those abstract aspirations have to be translated into concrete policy. And in the process of that translation, you know, power considerations have to be brought to bear. Are we strong enough to achieve our goals at a reasonable cost? Do they feel that they could achieve their goals at a reasonable cost, you know? And it's very clear when you look at it that for both sides, both the Soviets and the Western powers, the status quo of a divided Europe with the Soviets basically controlling their half of Europe, the Soviet zone in Germany, east of this line here, it's called the Oder-Neisse line, you know, and all these countries in Eastern Europe, you know, Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, and so on, Soviet power would be predominant there. They would be able to do whatever they wanted, pretty much, in those areas. We weren't going to go to war to force them out of Eastern Europe, to impose democratic regimes on Eastern Europe. And it was clear to everyone that America was not going to, you know, use military force, go to war, precipitate a Third World War to achieve that goal. And conversely, you know, Western powers dominated Western Europe. It conquered Western Europe. Western armies were still there. And these are powerful armies that existed at the end of World War II. You know, massive armies. The Soviets weren't going to precipitate a Third World War, which was what everyone knew would have happened, if they tried to march to the Atlantic and conquer all of Western Europe through force. Oh, maybe they'll win the initial campaign, but then the Americans will just gear up and mobilize their enormous industrial base and create such massive military power the Soviets would lose in the end. You know, it's like, it's an obvious calculation. You know, you don't get to be the leader of a state like the Soviet Union, for the matter of any state, democratic, non-democratic, without having a sense for power, for the importance of power considerations. You're not going to just plunge blindly ahead in pursuit of your ideology without regard to the consequences, right? That's the realist philosophy. That's the realist assumption. You apply that to this story, and you can see that the development of a conflict that could conceivably have led to a Third World War. And the Cold War was a very serious conflict. It was not a charade or anything. There were times when it seemed that a Third World War, meaning a general nuclear war after 1952, a general thermonuclear war, a much more serious thing, was highly likely. In fact, at times, a lot of people thought there was a good chance that war was imminent, especially in this awful winter of 1950-51, and then again and during the Kennedy period, the period of the Berlin and Cuban Missile Crises. This is a serious conflict. How do you explain it if both sides basically, you know, greatly prefer the status quo of a divided Europe to a third world war. How, you know, again, it's this fundamental issue that we've been concerned with over and over again. How do you have a war if no one wants it? Right? You know, where does the risk of war come from? Why should we be worried about the risk of war in the nuclear age? Because obviously no one wants a general nuclear war, and yet there's this fear that it's a real possibility. So that's the puzzle here. You wouldn't even see how puzzling that is unless you kind of brought a theoretical perspective to bear. Right? It's like the function of theory is not to, you know, answer your questions. In a sense, it's to confuse you. You know, you want to be confused. You want to be puzzled and say, because the puzzles act as a focal point for empirical research. The empirical research you do will have a point to it because the goal is to answer questions, to solve puzzles, right? And so we take that perspective when we look at the story. What do you find in 1945? You find, and I have to say that for me personally, this was a big surprise when I started looking at this stuff. 1945, both sides are perfectly willing to accept a sort of spheres of influence arrangement for Europe, right? It's the Americans, you know, these idealistic Americans who believe in democracy and so on and so on. It's the Americans who take the lead in proposing a settlement of that sort. Not overtly, not in a way that the public is gonna even see, you know? Here's one of the things about the way international politics works, especially for democracies. You have these statesmen. They're pretty much led, for a variety of reasons, to think in parapolitical terms. They're exposed to the harsh vagaries of international political life. You know, they wouldn't survive if they didn't have a sense for how to think in terms of power, to recognize the importance of power, to not pursue these kind of blind ideological policies. When they do pursue these simple ideological policies, and think of Woodrow Wilson or Gladstone in the 19th century, Jimmy Carter during the 1970s, you know, real problems develop. Okay? Normally, the international system kind of conduces the people who are responsible for conducting affairs of state in the international sphere. It pushes them to think in parapolitical terms, to understand the importance of power considerations. Okay? And as I say, you wouldn't make it to the top of any political system unless you had a feel for power. On the other hand, the people at the top of the political system, the ones who are responsible for shaping policy, these people are also forced to operate in a domestic political system. And this is true whether you're the leader of the USSR or whether you're an American president or British prime minister or whatever. You know, you have to maintain your domestic political base. You have to tell the people that you're responsible to, who ultimately will determine whether you remain in power or not, kind of what they want to hear. You have to package policy in a way that's palatable at home. So even though, you know, people like Franklin Roosevelt and Secretary of State Burns and, you know, John F. Kennedy, for example, they thought in power political terms primarily, they couldn't reveal that fact to the country as a whole. They had to frame everything in these, you know, grandiose, ambitious, moral terms in terms of the American ideology, in terms of promoting democracy and standing up for, you know, for justice and, you know, all this sort of thing. All right? So you have a gap here. A gap between these two sets of imperatives, the international imperatives and the domestic imperatives. So how do you bridge that gap? It's the simplest thing in the world. Dishonesty. You don't let the public know what your real thinking is. It's a particularly acute problem in democracies. But you have this kind of problem in all different political systems, but it's particularly a problem for democratic states. You can't be open about what you do. And this lack of transparency, the fact that the real thinking is very different from the way it's presented to the public, this, as we will see, is creates all kinds of problems. It's part of it's part of the price you pay for being a democracy. I mean, it's like you remember the very final page in that canon piece on American intervention in the First World War, when he kind of talks about this stuff and says, it's like this is a big problem for democracies in terms of the way they conduct foreign policy, and these problems are not going to go away, and we better figure out some way of dealing with this. Okay. So you have this this tendency on the part of the political leadership on both sides, in the Soviet Union and the United States as well, to think in power terms and to cut a deal based on spheres of influence. You see that at Potsdam. It's the most the Potsdam documents. Like I say, it's like the most amazing set of documents in the whole State Department's Foreign Relations of the United States series, because the real maker of American policy at Potsdam and through the year 1946, Secretary of State Burns, he had a very clear conception of what he wanted. Let the Soviets call the shots in the part of Germany and ultimately in the part of Europe that they controlled. In exchange for that, they would allow us and our friends to control things in Western Europe and Western Germany, all of in Italy and all of Europe west of the line of demarcation, right? And on that basis, we can get along with them, right? And they can get along with us, right? It's a divorce. We can't run Germany with the Soviets the same way we can with the British. We're too far apart in fundamentals. So let's have this kind of simple separation of interest. Divide things up, right? It's a simple, almost childishly simple way of resolving conflicts. Okay, and the amazing thing is, Stalin, loves this. He loves the whole Burns approach, right? Very quick to accept it. In fact, to extend it in important ways. And Soviet policy on the German question throughout the remainder of 1945 and through 1946 is based on the assumption that Germany's going to be divided. Right? The Soviets are basically going to create slowly, gradually, not in any really sudden way, a communist state in the part of Germany that they control. But he accepts the fact that the West is going to kind of do the same sort of thing. In other words, this notion is, Soviets could accept that the Western powers are going to control Western Germany, which is the most important part of the country in terms of industrial technological capabilities and thus war-making power. In exchange, the Soviets will control their part of Germany. Stalin says, it'd be okay for Western Germany to be organized under the auspices of the Western powers without us. What they don't want, however, is that Western Germany will be organized against them. And this we'll see is kind of like the key to understanding the Cold War. Okay. So you have Soviets making it abundantly clear at Potsdam and in the post-Potsdam negotiations relating to Germany in late 1945 and early 1946, especially in something that was called the Level of Industry Talks. There's supposed to be this kind of plan for seeing how Germany would be run as a unit. The Soviets went out of their way to make it clear that they considered this whole effort to just be this big joke, and they didn't take the notion of a unitary Germany seriously. As far as the Americans are concerned, we also, move ahead. Secretary Burns, this is, because this policy is basically concentrated at his level, move ahead in trying to work things out with the Soviets on the basis of that set of concepts. And this culminates in the Moscow Foreign Ministers' Meeting of December of 1943. And basically, you know, the whole notion is we can accept Soviet control, de facto control of Eastern Europe. We accept that as a precedent for what we want to do in the areas we control. And especially in late 1945, this is Japan. We want total control in Japan. We don't want the Soviets involved at all. And the argument that we make to them that this is okay is that, well, they're doing the same thing in Eastern Europe. But we're not going to cite those precedents unless we consider those precedents as legitimate. And so the kind of elements of an understanding are falling into place in the latter half of 1945. At Potsdam, with regard to Germany and the post-Potsdam negotiations about Germany, you know, Germany's going to be divided that way. That's the meaning of the Burns Plan for reparations. You know, I explained the logic of that to you last time. You know, it's like the basic idea there is each side takes whatever it wants from the part of Germany it controls. But the implication there is that you can't run Germany as a unit from the standpoint of foreign trade, exports and imports, if you have that sort of reparations arrangement. And then if you're going to have Germany as two separate units from the standpoint of foreign trade, that implies an overall economic division of Germany, and the implication of that is a political division of Germany. And that whole logic is thoroughly understood by people on both sides at Potsdam, and especially by its opponents who are railing against this. Right? British Foreign Office, British Treasury, and so on. Don't you understand you're going to divide Germany? Say, well, yeah, it's not a problem. There's a way we can live together, right? To try and run Germany as a unit, endless problems. You'll never be able to agree on anything, right? We have to pull apart, but there's no reason that the divorce should be bitter. You know, let's do it amicably. Let's have this arrangement. And as I say, by the end of 45, this is extended. They accept the fact that we are going to have total and absolute control in Japan. And we accept the fact that they're going to control Poland and Bulgaria and Romania, all these countries in Eastern Europe. I mean, Secretary Burns couldn't have been clearer about this at the September foreign ministers meeting in London. You just read the notes of that meeting over and over again. He says, well, you know, the arrangement we worked out for Poland, and by this time everyone knew that a communist dictatorship was being imposed on Poland, this is a perfectly viable a model for settling all these Eastern European things. And then the Japan thing should be settled in the same way. We also felt Italy, Greece, they're in our sphere. You know, it's clear by the end of 45 that there's this spheres of influence basic understanding that is taking shape, not just Germany, but much wider. All this is extremely important. Why? Because it intensifies the puzzle. It's like it doesn't solve the problem that we're trying to get to the bottom of. Right? It doesn't solve it. It's like, because if both sides are consciously, deliberately moving toward a spheres of influence arrangement and working out a whole series of deals that are based on that concept, then how do you explain the Cold War? See, if everything's being divided up on that basis, where's the problem? Right? And you can only grasp how fundamental that question is when you kind of immerse yourself in the empirical materials. Okay? And so, and yet we know there was a problem. We know there was a problem because by early 1946, and by that I mean February of 1946, March of 1946, the two sides are kind of screaming at each other. You know, they're blaming each other. The arguments focus on Germany. You know, the Americans are saying to the Soviets, "What nerve you have! You know, running things in your zone in Germany in a purely unilateral way." You know, it's like, what nerve you have not running Germany as a unit? The official, formal Potsdam Agreement seemed to imply that Germany is being run as a unit. Soviets aren't cooperating with that. It's an outrage. You know, they're violating their agreements. They're pursuing a policy that's totally at variance with you know, the American vision for how Europe was to be run, you know, self-determination, freedom, independence for all these countries. Because, you know, all this stuff is not true. But no one knew this at the time because the records of these Potsdam discussions were still highly classified. They were very secretly held. Okay? And the Soviets don't want to reveal that this stuff isn't true because they don't want to say, we don't believe in national self-determination. Because they have an interest in kind of cozying up to the Germans. So there are all these tensions that focus on the German issue and on the USSR's, you know, reneging on her agreements and this and that in early 1946. The key things here, Stalin gave a very famous speech on February 9th, 1946, which one very prominent American at that time, Supreme Court Justice William L. Douglas, referred to as a declaration of World War III. And the very next month, Winston Churchill, now, you know, he had been booted out of office by the British electorate right after Germany had surrendered, in the middle of the Potsdam Conference, in fact, British changed governments. Even before Japan was defeated, you know, the Churchill was out of office. But he came to the United States in March of 46 and gave this very famous speech, the Iron Curtain speech. I actually put it on the course website. I want to play it for you, but I couldn't get the sound to work here. You know, sounding the tocsin, you know, look how alarming this is. Look how outrageous Soviet behavior is. Right? Now, why is this important? Because we like to think that, you know, the great myth in the United States was America's this peace-loving country, and if you have the Cold War, it's because the Soviets wouldn't keep their agreements, and they're just interested in extending their power and opposing communist regimes on all these countries without any limit and so on. When you look at it closely under a microscope, what you find is not a shift in Soviet policy from what it had been at Potsdam, at the Moscow Conference, you know, the spheres of influence policy in Europe and Japan and so on in 1945. It's American policy had shifted. It's the Americans who now are saying Germany has to be run as a unit, whereas the Americans, especially at Potsdam, but in other areas as well. It's the Americans who seem to be thinking in spheres of influence terms, especially with regard to Germany. So I say the evidence in this area cannot be clearer. Okay? It's the Americans who shifted. Want to kind of get to the bottom of the whole question of what got the Cold War going? How do you explain what happened in early 1946? It's an American policy that you have to focus. You have to try and figure out why it was that the Americans, Potsdam, perfectly willing to have the Soviets call the shots in Eastern Germany, now think this is total outrage. Now shouting from the rooftops that these people have some nerve, you know, reneging on their agreements, not running Germany as a unit. Right. Okay. And so, what do you look for? As I say, there's this whole process in 1946. You find the Cold War heating up in February, March of 1946. In April of 1946, the Americans, the American occupation authorities in Germany, order a stop to the delivery of plant and equipment from Western Germany to the East. You know, which was a clear part of the Potsdam Agreement. The reparation stop of April 1946. You know, Soviets viewed as the Americans reneging on an important part of the Potsdam Arrangement, as in, you know, a view that was certainly correct. The American argument was, well, the Potsdam as a whole, the Soviets aren't keeping their terms of the bargain, so we shouldn't have to keep our terms. Okay? July, the Americans announced that since it's impossible to run Germany together with all the other occupying powers, they and the British are going to create what was called the buy zone. The Anglo-American buy zone, the heart of Western Germany. This would be organized under the auspices of the two Western powers. And Britain and America would run Germany economically, Western Germany as a unit. And then in September, you have this famous speech that Burns gave at Stuttgart, in which he basically said, you know, ultimately the German people are going to get primary responsibility for running their own affairs. We're going to help put Germany back on its feet, first economically, then politically. Okay? Very different. This is a strategy that looked toward the building up of Western Germany under the auspices of the Western powers. That strategy, it was rationalized with the argument that we try to run Germany together with the Soviets, but they're just impossible to deal with. You know, they're the great enemies of German national unity. They're the saboteurs of the policy that we had tried to pursue. Now, a lot of these steps were, on the surface, taken by the American military authorities in Germany, especially the military commander there, General Clay. And some historians have said, well, this shows you that Burns didn't have much say of what was going on. These policies were decided in the field for reasons that had nothing to do with high policy. Turns out that those claims aren't correct at all. And then, so we have this kind of puzzle. Why was it that Burns allowed this sort of thing to go on? Because, you know, he had a close personal relationship with Clay. The two men had worked very closely together during the war. But, you know, there's no attempt to say, you know, the Soviets are just doing what we told them they could do at Potsdam. Why did he allow the Soviets to be treated like that? Right? Could have stopped it. Well, what was he to do? Proclaim openly to the American people that he was in favor of the division of Germany, that his policy was based on, you know, basically accepting the post-war status quo, that it was resigning all of Eastern Germany to communist rule. Right? I can't do that. He has to work within the domestic political system. And, you know, people in the United States, they don't like this sort of power political approach. They believe in national self-determination and so on. You can't tell the German people that, we don't care for your national rights. You know, we've made this deal with the Soviets to kind of divide you up, and if you don't like it, the hell with you. I mean, they can't do that, yeah?
Are there private communications between Burns or others in the American administration for the Soviets telling them we're going to throw them under the bus publicly?
No.
But to stay with the Greens?
No, you just have these things happening, right? They're being told what the American policy is, and all these expressions of outrage on the part of General Clay to his Soviet counterparts, and so on. I'll tell you, some really amazing stuff here. Clay had a political advisor, a State Department diplomat named Robert Murphy, and. Murphy was in, he was getting his orders directly from Burns. And there's this document in the French papers. It's actually published in the published French diplomatic documents for this period. And basically, Murphy tells the French, we like the fact that you guys are creating all kinds of trouble for us in the Allied Control Council. You're obstructing the policy of running Germany on a four-power basis. You're vetoing the establishment of these central administrations, which are supposed to run Germany as a whole. Murphy tells the French, go ahead, be obstructionist. Don't worry about Clay getting mad. It's like, all this stuff goes on under the surface. People don't see this sort of thing at all. It's like, this is important. We cannot, in this country, pursue an honest and open policy. It's the same sort of thing we saw in 1941. Right? It's like there's an enormous incentive for domestic political reasons that the political leadership feels to stage manage things in a way that achieves its goals without offending the sensibilities of the public. And every time it comes out that the political leadership is not being straight with the American people, you find all this outrage in the press. How awful it is that they have not been straight with us. They've misled us left and right, as though this stuff is not built into the very structure of the system. Okay. Burns allows this kind of thing to go on, even though he knows better. Right? Why does he do that? Why does he, because this is creating real problems between America and Russia. And the whole goal of the policy in 45 was to get the two sides to, reach a certain understanding. Why does he do it? To answer that question, you have to look at Soviet policy, not in Europe, not in East Asia, but in their south, in the Near East. Famous story that the Soviet foreign minister Molotov told years after the event, that at the end of the war, he was meeting with Stalin. There was this big map of the Soviet Union. And Stalin points to Europe and says, I'm satisfied with that. He points to East Asia. He says, I'm satisfied with what we've gotten there, too. And then he points to Russia's south, to Turkey, to Iran. And he says, but I'm not happy with this. And in fact, in 1945, already the Soviets start pursuing a much more aggressive policy toward Turkey and then Iran, culminating in the Turkish and Iranian crises of early 1946. Iran had been occupied by the Allies during the war, because this is an important channel for lend-lease goods from America to reach Russia. And they, you might say, well, this is illegal. Iran was supposed to be neutral, but they moved in anyway. But they promised each other that they would be out within 6 months after the end of the war. And it was becoming quite clear the Soviets not only were not withdrawing, but they were supporting these kind of pro-Soviet separatist regimes in the north of Iran. And there was a big intimidation campaign against Turkey. The Soviets wanted all these rights, to kind of control the Turkish Straits. And their whole argument was, well, the Americans had the Panama Canal and the British had the Suez Canal, so shouldn't we have, as a great power, a international waterway of equivalent strategic importance? And so this stuff kind of comes to a head. And basically, the Americans make it clear very publicly in the case of Iran and secretly in the case of Turkey that this is unacceptable to us and we're willing to use force if push comes to shove. This is quite an extraordinary shift. How does it affect, what does it have to do with all this stuff about Germany? It dramatizes for the American leadership, especially for Secretary Burns, that the whole ideal of an amicable divorce is not going to work. Right? That it's only countervailing power that the Soviets respect. And in a democracy, the only way to generate that power is to start banging the drums, sounding the alarms, over-defining the threat. In the phrase of Dean Acheson, who was then Undersecretary of State, and later Acheson would become the Secretary of State in the second Truman administration, 49 to 53. Acheson said, we had to make things clearer than the truth. We had to over-define the threat. You know, and at the time, you could point to documents where people said, this is something we have to do. Again, it's this whole business, how dishonesty is built into the very fabric of American foreign policy making. You cannot expect the American people to be grown-ups and to think in pure political terms. Everything has to be this big moral issue, right? Aggressors versus victims. Right? Not like, well, we have interests, they have their interests, power is important. No, that doesn't appeal to people. Okay? We have to mobilize American opinion. We have to point to the Soviets. Look at how bad they are. Look at how they violated their agreements. Look how they pursued this policy of imposing these communist regimes on Eastern Europe. Perfectly acceptable to us in 1945. 1946 is an outrage. But it's not because Burns is an evil person. He has to work within the system as he finds it. You know, it's very similar to Kennan's argument, right, at the end of that piece. Very similar to the argument about Roosevelt in 1941. Okay. And there's a second target audience for this kind of new American tough line. The second target audience is the Germans themselves. We're building down our military presence in Germany very dramatically. You know, it's like in this period, the immediate post-World War II period, would tear up this amazing military machine that had been honed to a peak of perfection during the war. You know, everyone's demobilized practically overnight. Everyone wants to kind of go home. You have this whole generation, basically my parents' generation. They had suffered through all these long years of depression and then war, and now they want to, you know, get houses in the suburbs and buy cars and refrigerators and television sets. You know, this whole kind of and start families. You know, post-war baby boom, enormous political pressure to kind of build down American power. So basically, the presence we have in Germany is nominal. Enough to deter the Soviets because it serves as a tripwire. They ever moved in, sure, they could march to the Atlantic, but it would provoke a Third World War. All you need is a certain minimal troop presence there vis-a-vis the Soviets. But what about the Germans? How could a kind of small military force keep the Germans in line? Yet, no one thinks the Germans are committed to democracy at this point, right? How can we manage to maintain our control over them? And the answer there is you have to kind of bang the drums and point to the Soviets as the great enemies of German unity. You know, we're on your side. It's the reason you don't have a unitary state anymore. It's because of how bad the Soviets are. So you better side with us. Okay? That's the policy we pursue in 1946. And the Soviets sense what's going on. They play the German card themselves in 1946, trying to kind of portray themselves to the Germans as the champions of national unity, proposing arrangements for Germany that we fear the Germans might find attractive. And so this leads us to outbid the Soviets for German favor. I mean, it's kind of an amazing thing. Germans don't even have a state at this point. They're just an occupied country, and both sides are engaged in this competition for German favor. Okay. Why is this a problem? Why does this lead to the Cold War? Americans adopt a long-term strategy here. We take the lead. It's not the British or the French. It's the Americans under Burns who take the lead in pushing for a long-term strategy. What's the long-term strategy in the United States? Well, you look at the textbooks. They say it boils down to containment. There's this great sage, George Kennan, who came on the scene and came up with this whole idea that the guiding principle of American policy should be the containment of Soviet expansion. The basic idea of containment is kind of obvious. You don't need someone like Cannon to come on the scene. You know, we've shed a lot of blood, and we've made this huge effort, and we, as a result of that effort, we've acquired a certain position in the continent of Europe, and we've slayed the Nazi dragon, and we are not going to simply, you know, pull up stakes and go home and allow the Soviets to gobble up all of Europe, because the same problem we faced with Nazi Germany of a hostile regime being able to mobilize the vast resources of Eurasia into a military machine which would be directed against the United States. It was unacceptable with Hitler. It's unacceptable with Stalin. We're there. We acquired it with our blood. We're going to stay there, right? Containment, it's a reflex. You saw it in Potsdam when they decided not to set up a German government. No sovereignty for Germany means Germany is going to remain under occupation, which means America is going to maintain a military presence in Germany. Again, this big myth, the Americans want to withdraw from Europe after the war. Not true. Okay? Containment's not the guiding principle of American policy. It's something called the Western strategy for Germany. The Western strategy for Germany. What is that? Everyone should know what it is. Western strategy for Germany means that the three Western zones of Germany, the British zone, the American zone, and the French zone, would be organized under the auspices of the three Western powers, Britain, France, and America, that they would be organized first economically, then politically, then militarily, and that the new West German entity would be integrated into the Western world and tied into the Western world in all kinds of ways, integrated economically, politically, and militarily, ultimately. Right? That's the Western strategy. Why is this a source of concern, and why does this generate tensions? Soviets, I said before, they had no problem with the division of Germany in principle. You know, they were going to control their part of Germany, their part of Europe. It's obvious that the other side of that coin was that America and our friends were going to control the rest of Europe. Stalin accepted this. But it was one thing to say that Western Germany would be organized without the USSR, and it was quite a different thing to say that Western Germany would be organized against the USSR. But that was the connotation of the Western strategy. We're playing up to the Germans. We're condemning what the Soviets are doing. They're your enemies. We want you to side with us. You know, we're going to help you build up your power, right? And the sense was that the more the West needed Western Germany, the more the West would be obliged to give Western Germany what the Germans wanted. Namely, support for their basic political ambitions, national reunification, getting the Soviets out of Eastern Germany, you know, building up their military power, you know, giving them more in the way of political rights. Who could tell how far this process is going to go? And the West is going to be obliged to underwrite those revisionist German aspirations. We got to nip this in the bud, because if it's allowed to run its course without limit, there are going to be real problems for us, Soviet perception. Okay? You can see how there's a dynamic here. Not only can we see in retrospect that there's a dynamic generating tensions, because the more the Soviets want to nip it in the bud, the more threatening they become, the more we have to kind of build up our power, you know, mobilize opinion at home, play up to the Germans, and so on. And you can see how there's this kind of a spiral there. Okay? Not only can we see this today, but people at the time were able to see this. Right? And especially Burns, a successor of Secretary of State, the architect of victory in the Second World War, General George Marshall. He replaces Burns as Secretary of State in January of 47. Not because of any fundamental difference of political opinion between Burns and Truman. It was kind of a personal thing. Marshall comes in. He doesn't like the way things are moving. Right? He says, oh yeah, the Americans are in an anti-Soviet mood now. The American people can't sustain that indefinitely. All these people are traumatized by their memory of what had happened after the First World War. We need something more viable, more permanent, not a permanent state of nervous agitation. That doesn't work. We got to try and work it out with the Soviets. So Marshall makes this huge effort in the spring of 1947, this is. Spring of 1947, he's Secretary of State for just a few months. He goes over, he spends like 2 months in Moscow trying to work things out with Stalin, especially to work out the whole German question. There's no viable solution. What are you going to do? Go back to Potsdam? But Potsdam had proven bankrupt. You know, what's the solution? No real solution. And so Marshall comes back totally frustrated, and he says, we have no alternative but to move ahead with trying to put Western Europe, including West Germany, back on its feet. This is the Marshall Plan, spring of 1947, right? You know, deliberately designed so as to exclude the Soviet Union and Soviet-dominated states in Eastern Europe from getting this American largesse. Okay. Soviets react violently to this. Again, you can see the spiral. Stirring up the communist parties in France and Italy, very large communist parties in those countries to, you know, agitate against the Marshall Plan. And violent propaganda, you know, a ratcheting up of the war of words. Infuriating Marshall. There's one last attempt to see if something could be worked out. Right? This is the London meeting of foreign ministers, December 1947. So this French scholar that I very highly regard for, his name is Cyril Buffet, he refers to this as the conference of no return. This is when they cross the threshold. This is when they cross the Rubicon. Right? Marshall is so fed up with the Soviets at this conference, and their propagandistic, you know, stance and so on. He just, on his own initiative, says, I've had enough. He breaks up the conference, and he and the British and the French, then they move ahead with the next step of the Western strategy, which is to create a Western state in the Western zones of Germany, a West German state. A West German state that would be created in the context of being directed against the Soviets, right? This is what leads to the first great test of strength during the Cold War, the Berlin blockade of 1948. Okay, so let me break off there, and next time I'll talk about 1948 and to tell you a little bit more about how all this stuff relates to international relations theory. And when you get home, just go on the course website and click into the link of the Churchill Iron Curtain speech so you could kind of connect with the feelings of people at the time.